The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Hey, I'm Mallory Nopain.
And I'm Michael Paul Williams.
I'm a public radio reporter from Richmond, Virginia. And last year I was in Germany, studying how that society has confronted its terrible past.
I'm a columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and I'm here to ask whether America could ever do the same, confront our terrible past.
We're so glad you're joining us, but if you haven't yet, we highly recommend you listen to our prologue before continuing to listen to this episode. It'll lay out some details on what we're doing here and set you up to understand the series. It should be right there in your podcast feed. Go back, give it a listen. If you have listened, well, then let's get started. It's time to take a trip to Germany.
And then after, we'll revisit America.
We'll do that with you, Mike, when we return.
Now to Germany.
We're going to start in a backyard in Munich with three generations of German women. Hildegard, her daughter Claudia, and her granddaughter Magdalena. We won't be with them for long. I was with them for just one afternoon. But we're starting here because they taught me that coping with the past has taken decades in Germany. Generations, really.
Yes. I want to sit in the middle. Between us. Yeah. Yeah.
Hildegard Heffele is 83 years old. She was six when World War II ended, living with her family in the bombed remains of Munich. Her daughter, Claudia, was our host and translator.
My aunt and my mother sometimes slept in their beds with the clothes still on because when the sirens would start, they would quickly run down to the basement to be safe there. Sometimes they had to stay there for several days.
This family isn't Jewish. They're Catholic. They weren't persecuted by Nazis, but they did suffer during the war. And it's clear these are traumatic memories that run deep, despite the time that's passed.
And my mother is still afraid of going down to the cellar alone, so sometimes my son has to go down with her. I'm sorry, normally I'm not like that. Yeah, we all survived, so there's no reason for me to cry. So during the reign of Hitler, parents didn't talk about anything with their kids because they were afraid that if they said something negative and the kids would tell it to some neighbors, they would have to face the consequences. So they were used to not talking about politics with the kids. And after the war, people didn't say anything either.
So Hildegard grew up in a muffled world, a silence that extended to the tragedies of the Holocaust as well. It wasn't talked about, Hildegard insisted repeatedly when I asked. Not at school, not at home, not on the television.
So you really kept silent. And after the war, you didn't want to remember those bad times.
Collective silence defined that generation. Everyone's heads down, working to rebuild and survive. That changed as Claudia, Hildegard's daughter, grew up. She's now 50, and she remembers learning about the Holocaust at school, visiting Dachau.
So I was the first one of my family to go to the concentration camp in the 80s.
For her generation, the resulting emotion was guilt, shame.
Are you proud to be German?
In my generation, you aren't really proud of being German.
Where does that come from?
Because we still feel all that guilt, all the bad things that have happened.
Claudia's daughter and Hildegard's granddaughter 11-year-old Magdalena sits in her lap as we talk. She's been listening and has thoughts of her own. She says she is proud to be German, that being German is cool, because she has friends and classmates who are refugees.
Not everything is right, but I think much is right. And so when in other land is...
Other European countries?
European countries is... Was heißt Krieg?
War.
War. Then some people came to us, and I think... and I think it's like... that it's special.
From Hildegard to Claudia to Magdalena, three generations of German women, showing me how pain and silence slowly melted into shame, eventually giving way to a core sense of moral responsibility. How has this society pushed aside pride, instead transforming a sense of guilt for the past into a sense of responsibility for the present and future? And what was the foundation for that transformation? I'm Mallory Nopain, and this is Memory Wars, a podcast exploring how society confronts sin. When I hear the word Reconstruction, I think of post-Civil War America, right? That time period where the South is occupied by the victorious Union. But reconstructions have happened all over the world at different times. A reconstruction is a structural thing, a set of policies backed by military and legal enforcement, all with this goal of establishing a new government. That was true in the American South at the end of the Civil War, but it was also true in Germany after World War II. The German state was utterly defeated. The Allies, including America, split the country up and took over. And today, we often call that the occupation period of Germany. But in truth, it was a reconstruction, one that America helped lead, at least in West Germany. Just like America had led a reconstruction of the South. So, how did these reconstructions turn out so differently? To start to answer that question, I met up with a couple folks in a beer garden in a small town in central Germany. I had talked to historians about the policies of German reconstruction, but I wanted to hear about the life experience and worldview those policies helped shape.
Yes. My name is Gisela Böhner.
My name is Wolfgang Rose.
Gisela and Wolfgang are retired teachers and former colleagues who both lived through the American-led occupation of West Germany.
And who wants to describe where we are right now?
We are in a little village called Selbach. It's near a bigger town called Forchheim.
Wolfgang was born not far from here in 1948, just after the end of the war. His father had served on a German submarine.
His submarine was destroyed. It sank. And he was, these are things he told me, 14 or 15 hours swimming on the Atlantic with his colleagues, and there was someone who came by and just took them on board. In the end, he came.
Serving during the war changed Wolfgang's father. Wolfgang remembers how his dad would always keep his handkerchiefs folded and flat, constantly concerned for space, haunted by the memories of living on a submarine decades after.
He woke up in the night crying, opened the pump, be careful, and...
Open the pump, be careful, he would shout in his sleep.
At the end of his life, he became more and more, what's the opposite of talkative, silent, mute, yeah, more or less.
About half of German men fought under Hitler's command. the vast majority not by choice. It's not like people came home bragging about what had just happened. I read multiple accounts of medals or memorabilia stashed away in attics. Gisela, she also has her own memories.
Well, all of our fathers, I think, were in the war. I don't know anybody who has a whose father wasn't. I mean, this was normal. There were two types, those who talked about it. His father was one who talked, only some aspects. My father never said a word. Never, ever.
Gisela didn't know that her father had been a driving instructor in the army and drove around Nazi generals, or that later he was stationed in Africa.
And that's where he was a tank driver. And no longer generals, but tanks.
Her family only learned these things because they found photo albums after he died.
On a picture where he fried eggs on the tank because it was so hot and stuff like that, you know, naked bodybuilding pose and so on. Mm-hmm. And all these photos, we had no idea they existed.
Honestly, I'm a bit surprised that she could go her whole life and not have known these things about her father until he died. But she really isn't.
I'm sure the experiences weren't all pleasant. I mean, I think comradeship is okay, but seeing all your comrades die or seeing the enemy die, and I'm sure he saw terrible things.
Gisela says after the war, her parents wanted to let the past be the past, to forget things. But she was part of a generation that didn't let that happen, who questioned their fathers.
Dad, what have you done in the war? What did you do in the war? And he just said, this is nothing you want to know.
So some family history remains a mystery. But some doesn't. Gisela recalls another family photo album she inherited that had been tucked away, perhaps in shame. This album had pictures of one of her aunts, who Gisela says was an ardent follower of Hitler. In the photos, her aunt is a young woman posing brazenly in a fencing outfit, a swastika on it.
So it was obvious, yes. And I think after the war, you can always say in 45 there were two sides, those who felt they had lost and those who felt they had gained or won. And I'm sure my aunt felt she had lost.
Some Germans had resisted the Nazi regime, but for the many more who had supported it, the end of the war represented great loss. A loss of the twisted German pride Nazism had embodied. A loss of the Volksgemeinschaft vision, this vision of a racially pure, harmonious Aryan society. Alongside military defeat came moral defeat.
Now they felt they have lost, but they were also showed it. And I don't think they liked it, being shown that you have lost.
And that was life growing up after the war in Germany. Defeat. Shame, silence. Not openly spoken about, but known. And this is where reconstruction comes in. Because Germans like Gisela's aunt were shown they had lost by an occupying power. American troops and government officials took over and had a physical presence, making it abundantly clear that Germans had not been superior, that there was nothing to be proud of, that in fact, the reality of creating this pure Aryan society had been horrific, had been genocide. This is the English translation of a film called Death Mills.
20 million corpses. The product of 300 concentration camps all over Germany and in occupied territories.
It's about 20 minutes of disturbing footage from concentration camps. I could not sit through the whole thing. But many Germans were made to, at the end of the war, as part of this idea of Kollektivschuld, or collective guilt.
But these Germans, the ones who said they didn't know, were responsible too. They had put
the Americans made and ran this film briefly at the end of the war. In some places, Germans had to watch it in order to get their food stamps. And in the summer of 1945, the Americans also made posters showing Nazi concentration camps alongside the phrase, "These atrocities, eure Schuld, your fault." Many Germans might have first learned the full extent of the Nazis' atrocious crimes because of American-led efforts to make it visible. American occupation, this reconstruction, was initially shaped by this kind of confrontational politics.
All of this kind of delegitimized Nazi ideology and Nazi reality in those 4 years before a new German federal government came into being.
German historian Norbert Frey is an expert on this time period, which he says was all about making a clean break with the past by labeling the Nazi government as amoral and defeated. Frey says the Americans set the tone for that.
And this is why things happened like that people at the Buchenwald concentration camp, close to the camp, there is the small city of Weimar.
Many Germans would claim ignorance, but Americans wouldn't allow that.
And the Weimar people, they were guided through the concentration camp to see the corpses. Actually, everywhere where concentration camps were liberated, there was a policy of showing what was going on in these camps to the ordinary Germans.
Germans balked at this, largely rejecting the idea of everyone being guilty. In fact, Americans conducted a survey on German reactions to the film Death Mills, and they found that even after seeing the film, quote, almost no one would admit that the majority of the German people were responsible. So, although the collective guilt campaign did set an initial foundation, the approach didn't last long. Soon, the occupying powers switched to individually assessing guilt. Every German had to fill out this extensive questionnaire, accounting for their actions during the war.
They had to fill out this Fragebogen, this form with hundreds and more questions about their behavior and their party membership and their membership of Nazi organizations. So there was this political purge, if you will.
Germans were shuffled into categories from exonerated to major offender. Gisela remembers this. Her father-in-law went through the process, Entnazifizierung, or denazification.
During the Entnazifizierungsprozess, he was qualified as Mitläufer. And I saw the certificate where it said, Herr Böhner ist eingestuft als Mitläufer.
A Mitläufer. It means a follower. If you break down the word, it translates to something like to run with, like a sheep following the herd. The classification wasn't severe enough to earn Gisela's father-in-law jail time or hard labor, but he wasn't off the hook either.
And he was not allowed to work for 2 years, just because this was in the process. Very difficult to bring up a family without a job. So I say.
Many Germans would say the process was flawed, that if you had the right connections, you could work the system and exonerate yourself. But it did make open espousal of Nazi ideology impossible. It made it clear being a Nazi was not something to be openly proud about after the war was over.
The Germans very soon were prepared to distance themselves from this Nazi regime, which they, just a minute ago, they still had supported.
Historian Norbert Frey again. He says that even though many were left off the hook, the Reconstruction policies also forced people to distance themselves from their Nazi past.
They knew, well, I was tempted, I was corrupted by the Nazis, but now I don't want to be a Nazi anymore. This is important and helpful to create something new.
To create a clear statement.
It's a statement.
You created a normative statement.
Exactly.
About what's right and wrong.
Exactly. This is the point.
in addition to denazification, there was the much more straightforward policy of physical occupation. Americans and the other occupying forces invested time and troops for years. And as Germans in the West formed a new government, they knew the rest of the world was looking over their shoulders. It was under that pressure they sought to make it clear that the new Germany would be different.
And the federal Grundgesetz, the German basic law, it pours out of each of its paragraph that it's the contradiction of the Nazi past. Yeah, the first sentence, die Würde des Menschen ist unantastbar. The dignity of man is untouchable.
I too grew up in a place that had been shaped by an American military occupation, the American South. The more I learned about this reconstruction, the more I thought about American reconstruction. I was struck by the hypocrisy of the willingness of the American government to tell someone else they were guilty in a way we had never done to ourselves at the end of the Civil War. I mean, it makes sense. It's a lot easier to point out someone else's flaws than acknowledge your own. But I was still curious. How had this reconstruction in Germany created a foundation for Germans to first feel shame and eventually responsibility, whereas the reconstruction in the American South had not, had instead left behind a willful pride and arrogance? I know that there are cultural and historical differences that make comparisons like this tough, and not all historians buy that it is a valuable exercise. But I think it is, and I found others who do too.
My name is Jeffrey Herf. I am a professor of European history at the University of Maryland.
Herf's father was a German Jewish refugee, and now Herf is an expert in German history. And he, like many historians, thinks American Reconstruction ultimately ended in failure, while German Reconstruction did not. Herf says that at the start, U.S. Reconstruction-era governments did help create multiracial democracy. But as many have pointed out, that effort was destroyed by white politicians from the South and the North who chose to prioritize white reconciliation. In Germany, a lot of bureaucrats who had worked in the Nazi government were allowed to stay and work in the new government. But Nazism itself and the political force of anti-Semitism did not return to power. Herf says there are two big reasons why.
The presence of the Allies plus past German traditions, those two taken together, precluded a Nazi revival. And that is very different than the revival of, if not slavery, of Jim Crow and institutionalized apartheid and segregation.
Okay, let's look at each of these reasons in turn. First, the presence of the Allies. We've already been through the type of confrontational policies that set the tone at the end of the war. But the occupying powers also led an effort to keep Nazi ideology out of power in the new West German government.
Anyone who wanted a political career at the national level in Germany, West Germany, had to make clear that they were opposed to Nazism and not going to tell lies about what happened during the Nazi period.
Here's an example. At one point, 8 years after the end of the war, British intelligence caught wind of neo-Nazis infiltrating politics, and they stepped in to shut down an attempted coup. The occupying forces also put pressure on the media, shutting down any attempts to revive Nazism, and setting a standard that persisted past occupation.
A film like Gone with the Wind, or even worse, much worse, Birth of a Nation, that kind of a film would not have been made in the 1950s in West Germany. It would just have been seen as Nazi propaganda and would not have been tolerated.
So that's Herf's first reason Reconstruction worked in Germany, because of the committed presence of the occupying force. The second reason is past German traditions. The Nazis had been in power for 12 years. America had relied on chattel slavery for more than 200, a racist caste system that was the economic foundation of the country.
The forces within the South, within the white South, that would envisage a different kind of South, or a post-racist or a post-slavery South, were far weaker in the 1870s than those who wanted a post-Nazi democratic Germany in the 1950s.
There were people at the helm of the new West German democracy who had resisted Nazism and who had been part of democracy in Germany pre-Third Reich. They would go on to build a government distanced from the Nazi regime, a government that enforced criminal prosecution of hate speech and that would one day outright criminalize Holocaust denial. At first, Herf says, it was an elite few, journalists, academics, who spoke truthfully and openly about the Holocaust. But that tradition, over decades, took root and seeped in.
And the notion that telling the truth about slavery or telling the truth about Jim Crow somehow is humiliating or a source of shame or unpatriotic is just, from the perspective of the Europeans and the Germans, is stupid. If you want the future to be different, you need to focus on the truth about the past.
So Reconstruction in Germany began with this harsh confrontation with the truth. Photos of dead bodies plastered around towns. It progressed to individual confrontations of truth. What had you done during the war? And it settled on a grand coalition of truth. The government and others cannot deny the Holocaust. This transformation in Germany from silence to guilt to responsibility, it happened through mechanism and structure. But here in America, so many truths have been blurred for so long. I mean, my parents grew up at a time and in a place where it was taught the Civil War was about states' rights, not slavery. I can't help but wonder where we'd be today if Americans had instead had truth-telling drilled into our consciousness, if it was built into our institutions and systems in the same way. Would more Americans have a sense of shame for what our country has done? Would our relationship to the past and present, would it be more like Gisela's and Wolfgang's? I asked them what I asked so many Germans.
Are you proud to be German?
It's difficult because proud is not... It's a foreign concept for me, being proud.
May we correct you?
Absolutely.
Are you glad you are German?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. That's okay.
Yes.
Yes. As I said, I wouldn't like to be something else, but it's not a question of pride. You start.
I'm proud to be a German. It has got something to do with right-wing ideology in Germany and wording and with the past.
Yes.
And that's why I think I would never use the word I am proud of, because...
Yeah. What is it in German?
Stolz. Ich bin stolz, ein Deutscher zu sein. This is the... A phrase that went with the rightists,
Nazi
speak, and this is something I wouldn't say. And by the way, I can't be proud of something which I have so wenig, little influenced.
Yes, and
it's not our merit.
Yeah,
it's what?
Hmm?
What did you just say?
It's not our merit.
Yes.
Wolfgang doesn't feel like he can be proud of an identity. For him, pride is something you earn, not something you are.
Identity. I don't think I want another one. I'm happy with being German, and I think we have managed so far quite well to overcome what the past had for us, or all the Vergangenheitsbewältigung. I don't think we did badly. But we could have done more, perhaps, yes.
Vergangenheitsbewältigung. I've waited until now to introduce this word, because frankly, it's an overwhelming word. But when I tell Germans what I've been researching and working on, this is what I say. Vergangenheitsbewältigung. In a classically German way, it is a single word defining what I've spent a half hour trying to explain. The word means coping with the past, working through the past. And the Germans approach it as an ongoing project with a sense of collective responsibility, intellectual honesty, and self-critical analysis. And while that comes from a long history of German values, what I learned in exploring reconstructions was that it also was a process kickstarted by Americans. 77 years ago, it was us that created Your Guilt posters. We held up a mirror to the German people and set the foundation for their path forward. Can looking at their history possibly do the same for us today? Okay. Mike, let's talk. I'm eager for your first impressions here.
Mind blown about the You Are Guilty posters. Can you imagine how that would go over here? I mean, just the idea of white guilt strikes me as pejorative or perceived as pejorative. You are guilty. I mean, a collective You Are Guilty imposed upon Germans by Americans who would never impose that sort of idea on its white American citizens.
I think that was one of like the small details that when I first learned about it, just stuck with me. I mean, could you ever imagine something similar spread throughout Southern towns at the end of the Civil War?
No. That kickstarted the war all over again. We're just not a nation that does guilt. Why can't we deal with guilt? What is it about guilt?
It's shameful and it's uncomfortable.
But what else is it?
To deal with guilt means to admit that you did something wrong.
Yes, exactly. We're not even at that point. Where's the national apology for the enslavement of my ancestors? The power of the individual, that narrative in the American story, is a myth that's extremely damaging in my view. We can accomplish a lot more collectively than we can individually, but we are suspicious of collective action. And so if we were to deal with guilt in America, it would play out with a bunch of little tiny You Are Guilty posters, assigning guilt to each individual or particular individuals.
Well, okay, but in many ways, maybe we sort of see that unfolding today, but in many ways, we didn't even enforce individual guilt.
No.
At the end of the war. Take, for example, Alexander Stephens, vice president of the Confederacy. Someone you'd think should have been punished as a traitor to the United States, jailed.
The author of the Cornerstone speech.
The Cornerstone speech? I don't know what that is.
Laid out what the war was about. Slavery, slavery, slavery. The man kept hammering home that this is about slavery. People don't, he said the quiet part out loud. It wasn't even the quiet part, but for the lost cause folks, it's the quiet part.
Okay, so maybe one of the easiest people to say, look, dude, you are guilty.
Yes.
He goes on to become a U.S. congressman.
Congress is populated with a bunch of Alexander Stephens today. I mean, let's be real about it. A century and a half later, a culture that is like Dracula. You just can't kill it in America. Not to say the people in Congress are pushing enslavement, but they are pushing white supremacy. These adherents to what I would say is a philosophy that lives on a century and a half after the Civil War in our public policy.
In part because we did not have a successful Reconstruction.
We had the makings of a successful Reconstruction. When I look at it, when I look at what was achieved, when I look at people who were enslaved, populating Congress, people born into slavery, starting banks, all sorts of commerce, populating state governments, it's unfathomable. Just think about what predated that. This idea that Black people were so utterly inferior that they could not be trusted to inhabit any agency. And here they are immediately after emancipation doing incredible things because they were preparing to do those things and covertly doing those things before emancipation.
But then, of course, we have the resurgence of Jim Crow laws, the KKK, violent suppression of that active Black life, right?
Yes, because America, Union, North and South, valued reconciliation of white people over Black lives.
So for me, that's one of the really big lessons in looking at Germany is in terms of what needs to happen for successful Reconstruction, is that, of course, there will be a backlash, a resistance. It's not like Germans were happy with being told it's your fault. They didn't sit down and say, oh, yes, we are to blame. They felt like they were victims. But what's important to remember is that that victimhood backlash wasn't given power. Mm-hmm. It wasn't empowered by the new government. People couldn't stand up and say, oh, Hitler hadn't been that bad. Mm-hmm. That wasn't allowed.
Yeah.
And I mean, in one instance, there's this resurgent Nazi political party, and the new government declares the party unconstitutional because they're Nazis. The party's dissolved, the money seized by the state and redistributed. And so I think a successful Reconstruction here involves readjusting our idea of who gets power and accepting, to some extent, a willingness to strip power from people, from groups that we deem to be antithetical to certain values that we all agree on.
Yeah, that's tough. It needs to be on the table that we re-examine amendments like the First Amendment and the Second Amendment, which, especially the First, people would argue that's what makes America great. But the First Amendment has been weaponized for ill. The idea that we have speech that could easily qualify as hateful and demonstrably false, but it so influences our body politic and even our public policy, is destructive.
What you're talking about is sort of radical, because what you're suggesting is that we need to rethink some of our foundational documents and the way they support a system that isn't working.
We need to interrogate them, yes. And mind you, I'm not talking about a major overhaul of our founding documents. They, in many ways, have served us for good and are what part of what makes America, America. But we can't pretend that they haven't had their downside.
We have to be willing to be self-critical.
Yes.
We can't be overly proud.
Yeah, self-analytical.
Self-analytical. Mm-hmm. Yes. One tidbit that I think is interesting, and I almost immediately noticed traveling around Germany, is that you don't see German flags anywhere. Germans don't hang German flags, because it's along the same lines of saying, I am proud to be German. It's kind of, in polite society, not an okay thing to do. You're maybe betraying that you are right-wing nationalist. The only time it's acceptable to fly the German flag is when the soccer team is winning. Germans would tell me about, like, pulling the flag down from the attic or the basement and hanging it up when the team wins, but then immediately putting it back away.
That's fascinating to me, and I'm sure anathema to many of our listeners who just would totally reject the idea that there's anything wrong with flying our flag. My father is a World War II veteran, was a World War II veteran. And when he died, I got his flag, his triangle, folded up triangle of a flag that I keep in my office at home. And I'm proud of that flag because of what it represents. My father fought for this country when it was treating him like a second-class citizen. Don't ever tell me the black man doesn't love America. You could argue he loves it more. You could argue that we have spent our entire lives through the generations trying to make America real. But I'd feel funny about flying that flag in front of my house, and some of my neighbors do. And I haven't really explored why, but there's something about what it can suggest that gives me a bit of pause. I like the humility, at least, that Germany is practicing here. And I think our pride can be excessive.
So do you think that a successful reconstruction can still happen in America? Do you think that's something that we can achieve today? Is it too late?
Let me say this. It can't be too late, because if we don't act, it will be too late for America as we know it.
Next time on Memory Wars, we take a look at what it's like to live in Germany today if your family were victims of Nazi Germany. Why would someone choose to return and live in a place of such trauma? And what can a society do to welcome those who've been victimized?
But German friends are like, yeah, you're German. Okay, sure. Sure, you have your passport, but, you're not a real German. And I'm like, yeah, okay. I honestly, it doesn't offend me. I wanted to receive that citizenship as more of a way of reclaiming that heritage and as a way to be able to get here and spend time here, more so than needing to feel accepted.
That's on the next episode of Memory Wars. Memory Wars is a production of Radio IQ, distributed by PRX. This research and the resulting podcast were made possible in part by a grant from the German-American Fulbright Commission. I'm Mallory Nopane, and you also heard from Michael Paul Williams. Oluwakemi Aladasui is our story editor. Additional editing from Caitlin Pierce. Our music is by Sun Rain, with sound design and mixing by Chad Skinner and Danny Ramez of Half Moon Audio. Ruth Tam designed our logo and feature image on our website. And we recorded this episode at the studio of Virginia Video Network. Special thanks to Andreas Etkes for his guidance on this episode. You can find out more about the show and a link to suggested reading at radioiq.org. This podcast is supported by Radio IQ and the listeners who donate to that member station. If you appreciate innovative reporting like this, you can join those listeners by going to radioiq.org, and there's a donate button in the upper right-hand corner. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with the next episode.